I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with musician, producer, bastard pop mashup artist Nicholas Foster. We talk about everything really that encompass what I've just said there, as well as talking about other people's records as well, and we have a real deep dive. And it goes all over the place, this one, and we've got quite similar tastes in music, so it's a real cracker, and we discuss some wonderful records. I get my soapbox out, I start ranting about early 90s music and bands that I don't feel get enough respect, but you've heard that before, you've heard me get overexcited about that, and so there's more of that coming. Nick's a lovely guy, and you're in for a treat. A few thank yous before we press play on this chat. I'd like to thank Scroobius Pip, everyone at the Distraction Pieces Network, the team at Blue Murder Club for producing this podcast. Go check that out if you like your true crime. And there's some wonderful interviews with some fantastic people, a few of which have been on this podcast. So go check it out. And a big thanks to you lot for your continued support of this podcast. Thanks to Terry for introducing me to Nicholas, and Terry's been a real joy to work with over the last few years, and has been responsible for introducing me so many great guests, and this is another one of those. So what I should say as well, if this is your first time listening, there's lots of bands that we talk about today, and I should add that a lot of them have been on Off the Beaten Track already. So when you finish today's episode with Nick, why not have a look in the archive? Because there's 500 episodes, and I've been really blessed to have had so many amazing guests. So go and have a little rummage after this one and see what else you like the look of. Or better still, subscribe. Give us a little follow on the socials. Or if you're really up for supporting the podcast, head over to Patreon and watch this episode over there. And because we put up all the videos over on Patreon, we do a monthly live show that you're more than welcome to attend, where we just ask a question from the podcast. And me and a lovely bunch of Patreons, they're such kind people, we all just sit around and we have a little chat about records. And it's not a elitist thing, it's a really kind of fun, non-judgy, embarrassing at times thing. And we do it once a month. You can head over to Patreon and listen to a few episodes of that as well, to see if you fancy coming along. You can join these live shows with your camera off. They're all done on Zoom, I should stress. And you can join, but have your camera off and your mic off and just listening or watching. Or you can get really involved and have a good old chat as well. And you can find out about that at Patreon, patreon.com/offthebeatandtrack. And if you can support that, it's 70 pence a month, and you get so much stuff, and you get access to the archive of loads of unreleased stuff, radio shows and all the video episodes. And yeah, and essentially what you're doing is that 70 pence goes in the pot to ensure that I can sort of continue to do two free episodes every week, which is quite a lot, two episodes of a pod each week. And I'm not complaining. I get to have, you know, lovely chats with people like the one you're about to hear. So let's press play on that. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track Podcast with the delightful Nicholas Foster.
It's Off the Beaten Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. Nick, how are you?
I'm all good. Thank you very much.
This is maybe the third attempt to get this one recorded. Once you were you jumped on the Zoom call from a theme park with your kids, and I was like, I'm not sure this is going to work. And then I had an issue, but we're here, yeah. Which is the main thing.
Finally, we're
going to have a good chat about tunes. And I've seen I've had a peek at the list that you've sent over, and you've sent some wonderful records over. So I'm really looking forward to chatting them through with you.
Excellent.
So let's kick off the playlist. Nick, tell me the song that you think has the greatest ever intro.
Right, okay. This one's a particularly difficult one because you can name just hundreds of tracks that, for one reason or another, whether or not it's a horn blast or a guitar solo or something like that. But I've actually gone for something that's, musically very muted. It really just is a couple of scratches on the turntable before it comes in. So the track I've chosen is Rubber Without a Pause by Public Enemy. It's just an absolutely fantastic track. But I remember, because I suppose it would herald in the sort of second wave of hip-hop or rap.
Yeah.
And I remember because I'm originally from Gloucester, we were in a club called the Jamaican Club in Barton Street in Gloucester. And at the time... it was all kind of very 70s and sort of Stacks and various bits and pieces and sort of come back into sort of vogue. Suddenly the DJ just put this on and the place just stopped and just went absolutely mental. But it's more of the power behind Chuck D's vocal and the delivery when it comes in. It just packs a massive punch. Yeah. Just incredible. Just incredible.
Have you ever seen the performance of that on Soul Train?
No. But now you said it, I'm going to hunt that out.
It's off the fucking scale. It's so good, Nick. Present company excluded. I was so lucky and the most in awe I've ever been when I opened my Zoom chat at the beginning of lockdown and Chuck D joined me to discuss this, and because I think for people of our, you know, certainly of our generation, like Chuck D and Public Enemy were so important.
Oh, massively. I think, you know, up to them, obviously you had the Grandmaster Flash and the Purest Five and various other, you know, LL Cool J, etc. But I think Public Enemy were the first with a real voice.
Yeah.
It kind of almost had a punk feel.
Yeah.
And with the production that was just incredible as well.
Bomb Squad.
Yeah. And it just the way it was so gritty and so lo-fi. And I remember seeing a documentary about Chuck D, and he said that the whole thing about it was that they were trying to form a band.
Yeah.
As opposed to just being a sort of rap duo or anything like that. It was Public Enemy were meant to be a band, and that's how it felt. Absolutely incredible.
And they looked, I think with the not just with Flav but with Griff, they looked like a gang, and they looked like a force not to be fucked with. Like,
absolutely.
And I remember. You know, I'm 50, and I think, when did that come out? Maybe 88? And I remember, like, you know, being at school, and you know, I think when I started secondary school, we were still getting the kind of overlap of Flash and maybe some of the early, like you say, a little stuff, but all of a sudden, when it was Public Enemy, it was different, and it was like, and Public Enemy were coming. You know, there was the big show with Eric B. and Rakim, and it was like, you know, a few of my mates managed to get up to London to see Public Enemy, and it was like, you know, it felt scary, it felt punk, it felt
exactly.
And to this day, I think there's, it's still one of the most sort of smartest speakers in music. You know, whenever Chuck D talks, he gets my attention instantly. I think he's a real pioneer.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I was lucky, I think I saw him at Reading. And as with a lot of rap bands, you know, there were sound issues. Unfortunately, it sounded quiet and didn't quite have the impact. But I saw him lately, actually, a little while back with Prophet's Rage, Download. And that was incendiary. That was incredible.
Yeah. I mean, that's two powerhouses right there, isn't it? Yeah. To bolt them together. And coming through a Download sound system, that's going to be tailor-made for that level.
It's massive,
I saw them at Coco maybe 8-9 years ago. And it was told that Flav couldn't get in the country. And so it was like, don't get me wrong, Flav's a bit of a Wally, isn't he? But it was like,
it adds that whole, it's the whole.
It is. And as Chuck says, you know, if I want to get my message across, when I've got the clan there alongside me, the jester that's entertaining, it sweetens the message and gets it across. And it works perfectly. And I was like, I want to see Flav. You know, I want to see the clock. about three songs in, he just bounced from the back of the stage, and I was like, "Yes!" And I think he came on to shut him down, and it was like, "Oh, it was just phenomenal!"
Absolutely incredible, absolutely incredible. So yeah, so I could have picked a hell of a lot of different intros for various different reasons, but I think I'm happy with that. I'm going to stick with that. I think it's a good choice.
What were your nearlies? What you can have some honourable mentions. Well, what was you contemplating, Nick?
So, I think I'll send the stuff back to you. But I came up with Titanic Vandalism, which is an album track by the Go Team, but it's just sort of a massive cut up of horns.
Yeah,
and just flows absolutely brilliant, really electric. Have it something like Bring It Down by the Redskins. Again, another just choice horn tracks. Everything. Stargaze by Rainbow. Got a kind of great drum intro going on there. As you can tell, I've got quite eclectic tastes.
That's good.
All over the place. There's just hundreds and hundreds of tracks I can pick.
You've chose a cracker though, mate.
Thank you.
First song you remember hearing, Nick, that had an emotional impact on you, please.
Right, okay. So the first track was, emotional impact, I suppose, is quite a... I wouldn't say this was emotional impact. It's more about something that sort of stuck with me for... at that age. I grew up in a very large family. I was one of six kids. And all my brothers and sisters had their own various things, their musical tastes. So you get, prog coming from one room, punk from another, various, different things, different sounds, mainly on sort of rock basis. So I suppose when you're younger, you're trying to find your own thing, especially when you're amongst all that sort of stuff. And I remember, I was pretty young, and I think the new wave of British heavy metal was kind of on its way up. But I just remember hearing Motorhead, from the first album. And again, it had that kind of raw power, but wasn't punk. So it's more about that kind of, emotionally for me, kind of went, right, yeah, that's me. That's how I feel at that age. So as an emotional impact, I guess that's why I've chosen that song, because it felt as a spotty 10, 11-year-old.
Yeah.
it kind of spoke to me, and that kind of then helped sort of, well, totally helped, was my interest in music and started to cement it, I would say, because I've always been interested in music, because I've said I've literally been hearing music since I was three or four, being one of the youngest of a large family. But that kind of cemented my real passion for it.
Yeah.
So that was when it kind of went, right, okay. And, you know, when you're young, you want to be in some sort of group. You want to be in a tribe. Yeah. You want to fit in somewhere. And for that time, that kind of really spoke to me.
It's a powerful record, Motörhead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I suppose at the time, I mean, again, it was raw. Very raw. Doesn't sound probably as fast as it did then.
Yeah.
Because obviously Motörhead themselves have made a lot faster records since. But I just remember the time, yeah, it was just different. It was raw, but it wasn't kind of, I suppose it had a punk element, but it was kind of more, I don't know, more kind of gritty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stuff.
You mentioned that, you know, that you was one of the youngest in the family, and you know, siblings were exposing you to things like prog and punk and such. Like, how musical was home? Was there instruments about, like, you know?
Oh, yeah. So I suppose of the six of us, four of us have been in bands. And so we got a drummer, we got a good bass guitarist, vocalist. We had a friend one time that was trying to convince us to sort of make a brother's band.
Yeah.
Which we kind of completely disregarded at the time. But strange enough, this the guy who tried to persuade us went on to sign Radiohead. And so even when he totally disregarded his advice, we probably should have listened to him.
Oh, who wouldn't? Dear. He could have signed the UK Osmonds.
Exactly. I don't think it would have worked.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to ask you to tell me about the song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Okay. I'm just going to have to... So Iron Maiden, again, coming back to the tribal and finding yourself a tribe. So I went to an all-boys grammar school, as you do.
And where was school? Where was school?
School was the Crypt in Gloucester.
Right.
And lovely school, but very, again, you had just ska kids, your soul boys, your punks, your skins, and your metalers. Being a grammar school, it was kind of quite heavy. There was quite a lot of rock. Rock kids, I suppose, there.
Yeah.
In this. But so kind of, again, very tribal. But also, as I started school, I made them release Running Free. And it was just a very much, that was kind of my turntable all the time. I suppose at this time, as you could probably remember, buying a record was an expensive thing to do. So it wasn't like you could just ask Alexa to, play whatever you wanted. You'd have to spend your hard-earned cash on some vinyl. So you generally wear out either cassettes or vinyls or whatever of what you had. So do you remember, definitely for the early period of school, it was all things like sort of Maiden, Motörhead.
Well, why do you think, are we talking early 80s here?
We are from the early 80s, yeah.
And so at a time where, you know, you just mentioned, you know, I guess the second wave of sort of skinheads and the sort of tail end of punk, I suppose, moving into more your sort of like mohawk punk and then
Discharge BH.
And then sort of, you know, you mentioned sort of Scar and what was happening with Two Tone and then obviously you've got lots of electronic stuff happening at that time coming through. For somebody that has such a sort of wide taste in music and the things that I'm familiar with what you've done, I'm surprised that your background was leaning more towards metal at that point. Like, why was it that metal was the sort of thing? Was it just purely the most loudest and most angriest?
To be honest, I don't really know. As I said, my second rail was brother was really into his sort of hard rock and stuff. And, you know, so there was a lot of that sort of mid-60s psychedelia, a lot of the Doors and bits and pieces being played in the household. There was kind of quite a strong biker scene, I suppose, in Gloucester.
Right.
And I think you just, at that stage, when you're younger, you kind of just try and identify yourself with something.
Sure.
I mean, in the 80s, it was very tribal.
Yeah.
So you had to be something. You couldn't be just nobody.
I mean,
you had to sort of fit in one group or another.
Absolutely. Just talking about them sort of different tribes that we've just listed, like you tell me, you know, another generation where you could list off that many tribal groups, like, you know, and I think that is testament to, you know, when you watch these kind of retrospective Top of the Pops now, you know, from the late 70s and early 80s, they're so interesting and so exciting because
it's
there is no two things that sound the same on there. And it was such an explosion of genres of music and youth culture and fashion.
Absolutely. Like,
really exciting time. You know, when would you get Maiden next to the Specials, next to, I don't know, Lynx, next to the Exploited? It's crazy. Like, you know,
but brilliant. And to be honest, that was kind of, and it's actually quite, I suppose, a sort of sad testament to what's happened now with sort of algorithmic playlisting and bits and pieces where, you know, BBC and Radio 1 at the time always played that kind of almost, there was no sort of set. Johnny, it would play a lot of pop. There'd be a lot of pop on there, and there'd be a lot of sort of more because that's what sold. But then you get Maiden coming in, or you get Motorhead coming in, or you get I suppose GBH reaching the bottom end of the charts, or something like that, and various other bits and pieces. And again, more so when we kind of hit the sort of mid '80s with the kind of alternative independent, sort of charge. Then you really started getting, you know, bands like the Icicle Works and stuff like that coming through, and then obviously the Smiths and various bits and pieces like that. And again, because you had to, you couldn't pause, you couldn't fast forward unless you had it on cassette, of course, things, and you couldn't. So you had to, I mean, I remember sitting at home just listening to Radio 1 for the one or two good songs that I liked. And you have
with your fingers on the play and record button, ready to go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. just to pick those. Just the one or two songs that, you know, we said. And the thing is, you'd only hear them then.
Yeah.
And you might not hear them again until, you know, the next show in 3 hours' time.
Yeah.
There wasn't a case of like, all right, you know, and again, buying records was an expensive hobby.
Absolutely.
So you had to make sure that you liked these songs before you toppled into the shop with your pocket money and your hand to buy it. So, but again, it opens up. It opens up to all these sort of different genres and all these different types. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, I'm very tribal, didn't like rock. But if something else came through, that I thought, oh my God, that's actually really good.
Yeah.
And kind of led on to then growing away from the metal scene into other sounds.
But even the, you know, you'd say like Radio 1 would be playing lots of, you know, pop as well. But when you look at back now at what was pop then, you know, if you look at OMD, you look at Soft Cell, you look at Duran Duran, you know, this is high level pop music. You know, this is not some manufactured, you know, something that's come over from like, you know, a couple of brains in Sweden. This is like, you know, bands experimenting with new technology.
Exactly, and new sounds.
Yeah.
And they're all kind of influenced by the likes of Bowie.
Yeah.
You know, Kraftwerk.
Yeah.
All the sort of great innovators.
Yeah.
Of the time. And you can kind of see the lineage of the way. So, yeah, it's pop.
Yeah.
But it's pop.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
It's a good name for an album.
But, yeah, I mean, you say very sophisticated but very well written, very, you know, and again, a lot of it, tonally, when you look back on it, it became popular but didn't really fit.
Yeah, yeah.
So, as you said, yeah, it's not like, you know, say a couple of producers in the Netherlands do four on the floor house stuff, cheesy house stuff. It was, I mean, it was a great time to be alive. Absolutely, you know, the best time.
did music present itself as an option, you know, as for something that could be work for you when you was at school?
No. In fact, I was terrible. Our music classes were very much, I think I played the violin for a little while. Yeah. Soon gave up when I think my brother threatened to kill me if I guess I'm playing it. But no, I mean, we were kind of, our music teacher was very classical. His prized possession was this massive great big organ we had in the school hall, and that's kind of where we clutter around, and he'd sit there playing around.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was never, music at the time wasn't kind of something I thought of. I just something I loved.
Yeah.
I think, you know, probably at the time I wanted to be a vet or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
I was into my art as well. I could draw. So that was kind of more of a step towards what I was planning to do. It was much later, in my mid-teens, that I kind of really started picking up a guitar. So.
Yeah. Did it feel that at that point in, you know, in the school system in the UK, like the sort of creative, you know, the creative options where.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Grit BR or music were never actively encouraged.
Not in that way. Not in, yeah. You know, not in a way that I suppose they wouldn't be now.
Yeah.
I've got friends who are music teachers, and I think it's a lot more kind of hands-on with new technology and tools and creating and performing. Where then it was a case of just being an orchestra.
Yeah.
When there, then, you know, why bother?
Yeah.
And again, the same with art. You know, it's more seen as a pleasurable thing.
Yeah.
But I suppose you look at it back in the days where, you know, 4-5% of people went to university.
Yeah.
So the rest of us went on to, you know, your apprenticeships or something on that side. So, yeah, and again, coming from somewhere like Gloucester, where the aspiration isn't there anyway.
Yeah.
It's not that, you know, people from Gloucester never became famous.
Yeah. I'd love to be going to study music now, because literally every music college now, most lecturers or teachers are people from my favourite bands from the 90s.
This is true. This is quite true.
I went to Birmingham, Brighton, to interview Martin Rossiter from Gene. And he was like, in that room there, it's one of the guys from Sleeper. He lectures in there. And Justin from Elastica, he's up there. Yeah. And I know that James from EMF's a teacher. And
he's up in Yorkshire.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, oh my god! And I was like, I know James a little bit, and I was like, do you not like parents' evening and like the mums and dads not just going, holy shit, it's James from EMF. Oh, wonderful, wonderful!
Actually, strangely enough, I remember phoning James one time, and he was obviously in school, and the kids were about to come in, and he had to sort of tell them to go and wait, and so in a very authoritative manner. And I was like, really?
Love it. Yeah. Okay, let's talk record shops, and I'd like you to tell me the first song that you remember buying from a record store, please, Nick.
This is probably, well, it was Merry Christmas Everyone by Slade, Everybody by Slade, which would have been probably the Christmas number one at the time, I guess. Yeah. It's back in the 70s. So I would have been very young, and I think I had 50p to spend, because my birthday is on the 27th of December, so it would have been just after I would have got some birthday money.
Yeah.
So I must have been ridiculously young, but I do remember going in with mum to purchase it. And so obviously, you can see the love of music started from there, even if it was, one for Nolly Holder.
I mean, what's not to love? Certainly as a kid, I've said it before on this podcast, but my favourite quote ever is about that Slade. He's from Noel Gallagher, and he said they wrote proper fucking tunes, but they look like fucking Diddy men, and it's like bang on.
It's too bad to bang on. It's like, what the hell is this?
But Noddy's voice, amazing.
Yeah. Oh, just incredible. And they were proper. Well, I suppose they marketed originally as a skin band.
They were like Suedes, weren't they? Like
yeah, absolutely, yeah. But yeah, a proper stomper.
Yeah.
Again, it's one of those sort of classic things that kind of goes in and out of vogue depending. Come Christmas.
Yeah.
Everybody loves a bit of Slade.
So tell me a little bit about how you kind of sort of found yourself moving more towards, working within the music industry.
I think I started my first band when I was about 15. By that time, the kind of independent sort of sector had kind of what we could now call indie bands.
When was this? What year roughly?
So it's about 84-ish.
Right.
84. More around 85. So we've been listening. You kind of, metal had become a bit stale. Obviously, things have been entering into the charts, so we're kind of pricking my ears. I remember Tears for Fears. Mad World, when that first came out, and The Hurt in the First Hurt, the album came out.
Massively underrated, that record.
Oh, it's just brilliant. The first album's absolutely fantastic. But I think that was the album that convinced me, that and Heaven Up Here by Echo and the Bunnymen, to have my hair cut. And so I remember going into the hairdresser going, with a picture of Ian McCulloch, going, can I have that, please?
Yeah.
And the girl at the time going, oh, I'll tell you what's trendy at the moment. Said, having it a bit spiky in the front and long at the back. And so I ended up having a mullet.
So close to having a good haircut, and at the last minute you fell.
I didn't know what to say. This girl seemed to be certain, and what she was giving me was something really trendy.
Oh.
Didn't last long.
McCulloch's my favourite. I said that one of my favourite things that said about Suede was Noel Gallagher, but when it comes to quotes, and obviously the Gallagher brothers are very famous for being gobshites, but McCulloch takes it to a different level.
Oh, yeah.
My favourite from him, he was being interviewed, and he went, I remember the day when Bono met me, and I just felt fantastic.
This is good, yeah.
Like, not the day that I met Bono, the day that Bono met me. Love it.
But the thing is, again, it's because my wife's a big U2 fan, and I can't stand them.
Yeah.
Because I was always a Bunnymen fan, and because of the rivalry, or kind of pretend rivalry at the time, I guess, I always felt it's like, oh, I can't listen to them. I can't.
Yeah.
But the Bunnymen, it just is super in comparison. But yeah. That's the problem. So we have lots of arguments. She comes in, puts you two on, I've got to walk out of the room.
Yeah.
That's a few things that childish you still live with.
Yeah. Even though your haircut you had at that time was more similar to probably what Bono had than what McCulloch had.
Yeah, almost definitely.
So it was bands like that that encouraged you to pick up a guitar?
No. in saying that, is probably, I'm thinking about it, again, it's probably coming on to my last question, answer to the question, were bands that preempted that. So it's more around the sort of Pillows and Prayers, Cherry Red time, when you had all these little obscure bands coming through. So it's about 81, 82-ish that I kind of became more aware of this sort of stuff. And bands like the Monochrome Set and... but also other bands, 23 Skidoo, various other things that were kind of coming through. It's kind of like you had Teardrop Explosion, you had the Bunny Men and stuff that were coming out, and kind of a new psychedelia, but that sort of spread out into all these other weird, a certain ratio sort of bands and stuff that were coming through really, you know, below the radar. I mean, real big Peel favourite type stuff. And The Fall. One of the earlier, I think we had Lives of Rich Trials. And yeah, I think it's my older brother, my slightly older brother, said I've got lots of them, Richard, that kind of started then, started playing and introducing us into all this kind of new music that kind of didn't fit into the kind of rock or psychedelia type thing. And it was those bands that started influencing us, I think, to start playing. And then when R.E.M., Smiths, etc. came through, and the Bunny Men became more, popular, and The Cure and various, and that's kind of then led us through. But then, in some of my first bands, I think our main influence was probably The Stooges.
Yeah.
You know, again, also... had been listening to things like The Stooges, had to be listening to things like Frank Zappa, you know, Freak Out, Captain Beefheart, all these sort of things. A lot of 60s garage punk had come through as well at the time. So just things like that. Bear with 1 second, Stu. Sorry, people coming into the house. These sort of things. You've got a free afternoon. But yeah, so a lot of that had really influenced me sort of picking up the guitar.
I mean, that was an important time because, you know, if you look in the UK, what was at the top of the charts, you know, in sort of 86, 87, you know, you're moving into the sort of territory of, like, you know, wet And I guess bands like Tears for Fears have become more sort of stadium bands at that point, and you know they've moved into like arena rock. Really, don't get me wrong, I love that band, and I'm not saying that as a bad thing, but it did feel like the underground heroes like the Bunny Men, REM, and the Smiths were starting to, you know, become a massive force to be reckoned with. I think, am I right in saying that do you know what I was. Who was I talking to? I might have had Mike. I was chatting to Mike Joyce, I think, about this, and he was saying that that the Smiths were selling out bigger arenas in America than Tears for Fears in 86, 87. But in the UK, they just weren't like as big as, like, as, you know, people thought Tears for Fears were this like huge global band, which obviously they went on to become. But he said, we was playing the same size stuff as them, and we were just seen as these sort of underground heroes, really. And it was phenomenal. And one of the things that always blows my mind, and watching a recent documentary, is the fact that, I think they were all like 20, 21, the Smiths, and doing these world tours. And at that point, like, Johnny Marr, unquestionably the most prolific songwriter on the planet, I think, you know, for a good few years, was also managing the band, insane. I mean, I don't know if you remember what you was like at 21. I could barely manage to get myself down the pub, let alone manage the Smiths, like, and write all their songs, like, prolific.
It's amazing. But then I suppose that time was, it was an amazing time. It was a very furtive time. For music and people with ideas, and then people putting their own ideas into action and the rise of the independents.
Mm.
You know, and again, that's something that's all stuck with me over time. I'm kind of a bit of a label geek.
Yeah.
So, you know, I remember at the time actually going into the local record shop and looking at the cover of bands and the label, and you check and you say, all right, you say Catch 22 or something like that, or, you know, Creation or obviously Rough Trade, that you kind of could take a punt on it.
Yeah.
And again, going back to the fact that, you know, Time Vinyl was quite expensive. So, you know, you kind of had to, if you hadn't heard of something, you kind of had to go by the label and what, how well.
What a wonderful thing, though. Like, how wonderful is that? There's a comfort in knowing that if it's on that label, I'm in a safe space there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I don't know. I wonder how many people, you know, through... You know, young people discovering Oasis then went on to go, all right, I'd never have found Ride or Swerve Driver or Fan Club or any of them bands had it not been for that kind of gateway.
It's true, yeah.
Yeah, and the same for Rough Trade and, you know, the Smiths. It's like,
yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. No, it was, I definitely don't envy the youth of today.
Yeah.
With this the algorithmic programming where, oh, for everything's for fans of.
Yeah.
So they're here, it's like an echo chamber.
Yeah.
You don't need to hear anything different. And I think, you know, one of the reasons I've gone from liking, you know, metal into literally everything and anything is because, you know, I was given the opportunity to hear it.
Yeah.
As opposed to just going in and going, right, okay, I like this band, play something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I certainly think the 80s were definitely a wonderful time.
Yeah.
And definitely a wonderful time for bringing new and exciting music in. Probably wouldn't argue it was the best musical era. I know a lot of people think it is. But I'd probably say, on a whole, probably the 70s were probably the best musical era. If you look on the fact of everything it spawned and the fact that it had that experimentation in the 60s and polished it. But that's a much bigger argument. That's a pub argument.
I'm one of the latter ones. I'm like, for me, 80s. Like all of the stuff that we mentioned at the beginning of the 80s, and that's before we get to the stuff that we've just spoke about with the Smiths and REM and the rise of the indies, right the way through to the big evolution of hip hop and house music, acid house. And Manchester, you know, all the stuff that happened at the end of the 80s.
It's true, okay, yeah, I love we're within the argument. It's one over a few beers.
We'll stick a pin in it till we have a pint,
absolutely,
mate.
Absolutely.
Well, look, I've just mentioned sort of acid house and the evolution of, I guess, what become rave. So that's a nice little segue into clubbing. I say that, but this question can lend itself to anything. Whatever was going on in the dive bars, pubs, clubs that you found yourself in your sort of formative years. So with all of that in mind, tell me the song that soundtracked your years clubbing, please, mate.
Okay. So It Takes Two.
Oh, what?
Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock. Right, it's a weird one because it could have been Bang Goes to the Batmobile by Todd Terry. Could have also been, they were kind of dual tracks for me. We just moved to London and been hitting the acid clubs, the new sort of acid filled clubs. And I remember going down to the Mud Club. And
who was DJing? Mark Moore?
I got no idea.
Yeah.
Really wouldn't know. I think, strange enough, I used to go down there with Mr. Atkins, James Atkins.
Oh, wonderful.
In London, or took him down to the Mud Club. And it was our kind of first introduction to, not acid house as such. I remember my brother having the acid house album and the Chicago house album before, but it's the first time I've actually had kind of clubbing thing, because we were much, up to that point, we were really sort of gig goers and didn't really go to nightclubs, because that was kind of where, you know, the Traces and the Chavs, what we call Chavs now, were used to frequent. So we were kind of more, we'd go to gigs. But obviously moving to London, and it was the kind of new thing. So yeah, I remember dressing up in sort of paisley and tying bandanas around our heads, and off we track. And I just remember that song being a standout track.
Yeah.
Probably because a lot of the other tracks were, again, loopy and bloopy.
Yeah.
Where they were thrown in. So it wasn't an acid house track as such, but it would be thrown in
to
the mix and would work really well. Well, I suppose, say, Bangles of Batmobile was more of a house track. But just loving it. Just loving that whole, I think it's probably 88, 89, maybe. And it being very underground.
Yeah.
And it feeling very underground. And again, with that kind of indie punk spirit where, you know, I'm in the press going, oh, you know, everybody's dropping these terrible thing, acid house. But I just remember it being a really good time. And obviously from that came the sort of rave culture, kind of Second Summer of Love and all that sort of thing. And again, it was just a wonderful time to be around.
Yeah.
Again, a very, very non-violent time.
Yeah.
I remember it feeling safe to go to clubs, I suppose. And the clubs weren't your typical pickup joints anymore.
Yeah.
It just seemed to be a kind of just everybody would go down and just dance. And
so strange how the press deemed it the most ridiculously horrible, you know, thing that Scourge and anybody you speak to that actually went has a very different take on it.
But again, it was the start. It was the start of that, say, that coming to Manchester in the second Summer of Love, where, you know, it was just a really good, peaceful vibe.
Yeah.
And I said, everybody just go to the club and dance. We just dance solidly. But it was, just a fantastic time. Absolutely fantastic time.
What drew you to relocate to London?
To make it in the industry.
Yeah.
So,
planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
So I think with my bands, I was in a kind of one of the sort of, I suppose, bigger bands in Gloucester, which is not saying much, to be honest, but the fifth biggest band in Gloucester or something like that. But we still split. And so it was just like, right, okay. Some friends of mine gone to uni in and around London. And we kind of just, a few of us then decided to go up. So we kind of went up, dribs and drabs of us, but by sort of 89, there was kind of a bit of a community of ex-Gloucesterites living in London. And again, this would include James Atkin, came up for a while. He then went back and then formed EMF. But you had Keith Rosencroft, who is the guy we told you before, who mentioned in the Brothers Bands, he's a family friend, who then went on to sign Radiohead and became president of Parlophone and other labels. And then we would meet other people as well, because I got a job in Tower Records. So at the same time, I worked with Lawrence Bell, who obviously now owns Domino Records. And it was just an assortment of lots of different individuals, again, came up for the same reason. Everybody was just trying to break it into the music industry. So that's kind of, yeah.
And where was you musically at that point? What was you sort of aspiring to be in a band, or was you embracing kind of the production and the kind of DJ culture? What you know, because it was all happening at that point.
I was in a band, so we formed a band called Millhouse and we just played you know, the Blood and Gate a lot and various other of the. I suppose what they call toilet venues.
Yep.
Yeah, quite a bit.
I've played them all to death as well, mate. Yeah, exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. It was a great time. I think at the time, I think actually by the time that the band actually started actually playing and coming on, we'd moved away from, I don't know, the baggy period, I guess. Because I remember we were playing, we didn't play with, but playing within the same circles as Census Things, Mega City 4, Perfect Days, various other of those sort of the new, I think called it Fraggle Rock or something like that at the time.
We called it Grebo.
Grebo bands.
Obviously, you know, sad to see the passing of Mark Heads last year. But
yeah.
I mean, for anybody that never got to see the Senseless Things live, you miss watching Morgan Nichols, that bass player, be the most incredible thing you will ever see on stage. Yeah, it was insane.
Like. Absolutely. Yeah. They were brilliant. Absolutely. It's a real, obviously, it's very sad about Mark. But at the time, and you go and see him at a place like the Bull and Gate.
Yeah.
So they absolutely rammed. And they were kids. They were kids.
Yeah.
Literally were kids.
Yeah.
It was a great time. So, you know, the band was very similar, in a similar vein. And of course, that was sort of preempted grunge.
Yeah.
It was the kind of UK grunge before. And a lot of the influence was coming over from the States at that time. Yeah. So you have, and again, because I worked at Tower and Lawrence, and he'd be bringing all these things in and suggesting we go and see this band. I remember he suggested going to see Tad play, and I was like, I'm not going to go and see some of your whiny American bands, Lawrence. And at the time, the support band was Nirvana.
Yeah.
So I decided not to go for that. So...
That's again, two catastrophic mistakes. You've just bypassed seeing Nirvana and your mullet.
I've literally got a whole family of them. I can reel them off, trust me. I'm going to Spike Island because I decided to go and see my girlfriend in Gloucester instead. Or I can just reel them.
Well, you've said the word Gloucester a lot, so that leads us lovely into track six, and that's a favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
Yeah, not a great deal of talent coming out, to be honest. Really.
What you got? What we got? What's come out of Gloucester?
The Wurzels. Well, in fact, they weren't even... Well, I actually cut their words from Gloucester. I think the rest of them were more down to Somerset. I'm speaking, my accent's coming out.
It's the word Wurzels, isn't it?
It is the Wurzels. Trying to hide this thing. That was it. I think there were some 60s sort of bands, maybe Seekers. Maybe I'm not sure. Come from that our neck of the woods. But really nothing. There was a missed opportunity with a band called Apple Mosaic that were...
Apple Mosaic?
Yeah. They became EMF.
Of course they did. Yeah. It was the Indentures thing, wasn't it?
The Indentures, yeah.
Yeah.
So, who were brilliant, absolutely phenomenal live, but they got signed and couldn't capture the same energy, live energy.
Yeah.
So, in fact, some of their demo tapes are better than anything they sort of professionally recorded, especially some of the live tapes, just incredible. So that was kind of a missed opportunity that never really came up. But obviously, coming out of that, then Ian joined up with James, and then EMF became the thing. So, which is, you know, obviously fantastic. And to be honest, I remember, again, seeing them in their formative years and thinking that EMF, Unbelievable was a definite potential hit.
Yeah.
So, out of all of the tracks at the time. And you know, obviously the rest is history.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, but
it's such an exciting... I mean, I got to see they come and played my venue on one of the early tours. That they looked like a boy band as well. You know, they were all so cool, so handsome, and like, you know, James was this ultimate pretty boy, wasn't he? And I mean, God, there wasn't a girl on the planet that didn't fancy Zach. What a band. And to have a number one stateside, you know.
It's just absolutely massive.
And I say this a lot, you know, that you mentioned that kind of pre-grunge thing.
Mm.
And the music in, you know, the music papers and documentaries, when they look back, they always go, and then the Stone Roses happened in 89. And then in 1991, Nirvana happened. I'm like, whoa, hang on.
Yeah, there's a big thing between.
There's a lot that happened in between. I tell you what, the Stone Roses and Oasis never done. They never had a number one in America. And in between then, Jesus Jones did and EMF did. And they were fusing like all the exciting things that were happening in electronic music, you know, to all the things that were happening in guitar music. And it's such an exciting time. I say that because I hit 18 at that point, you know, and you know, it was the t-shirt band time, you know, and you know, whether it was Carter, Stuffies, Poppies, EMF, like it was such an, all of these bands were so colourful, so fun to be at their gigs, and
absolutely, and it used to be like mayhem.
Yeah, and they all had great songs.
Yeah,
really good singles, but they just get overlooked. I think Miles is one of the greatest songwriters of his generation. You know, the Wonder Stuff's hits are ridiculously catchy.
Absolutely.
But they get erased from all of these documentaries and you know, books.
Even though they went on to, they all had big hits and stuff like that. I remember listening to Eight Legged Groove Machine, just thinking it was the best. And I think it came out simultaneously as the same time as Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
Destruction. And then hearing Info Freako for the first time.
Oh my God.
By Jesus Jones. And I remember playing it to James going, listen to this.
Yeah.
And it was just incredible. They were absolutely brilliant times.
Yeah.
Absolutely want to be. And then again, great time to be back in the live scene and seeing kids.
Absolutely. And I just wish it gets... I take any opportunity and listen to this podcast. I've heard me bang on about it at every opportunity I get. That time, that little period of time where, you know, you had bands like Carter and you know, the Stuffies and that, like headlining, like, you know, Stuffies headline a football stadium and, like, and you know, Carter headlining Glastonbury and things like that. It's like, these are huge bands with, like, you know, number one records and number one, you know, number one albums and stuff. And they just kind of get forgotten.
The sidelines,
I think it's a real, real shame because it was...
It's a massive shame because, as I said, you're right, they were bright, colourful. It was...
Yeah.
Exuberant. But they had absolutely great... Yeah, killer pop songs.
Yeah, and you talk about, you've started me off now. You talk about, like, you know, them pivotal moments in electronic music. Whether you talk about, you know, you mentioned Todd Terry earlier, but you know, or you talk about, you know, Strings of Life or Frankie Knuckles, yeah. And then you know, yeah. you know, you talk about the Smiths and REM and things like that. When people are referencing like a How Soon Is Now or a Fool's Gold or a Your Love or a Strings of Life, Info Freako should be in that conversation because yeah. It fused it. And it was pioneering in what it was doing. And it just never gets its kind of just deserves, I think. And I'm not the biggest Jesus Jones fan. I like some of the early stuff, but that track, it's a fucking masterpiece. I'm gonna rein it in and get carried away.
I'm just thinking, right, I'm gonna put that on as soon as we get off this call. they were great times. They were great times.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, look, this is your time to be a tastemaker now. Mm-hmm. Tell me a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to hear.
And again, stupidly, it's one I can't pronounce. I thought about it, but it's again heralding back to what we were talking about before, and when you're looking at bands that. Potentially should have been a lot bigger than they were, and include their influence. So I've chosen a track by the Monochrome Set. Now, the Monochrome Set were kind of around in the late 70s, early 80s, initially. But their influence is kind of really felt with the Smiths, felt where Franz Ferdinand, et cetera, were always massive fans. And again, they made these sort of explosive, jangly indie hits before it was kind of that trendy to be jangly and indie. So this was from that Pillars and Prayers album, I think I mentioned earlier, which is a compilation, Cherry Red compilation album, and was kind of the standout track. And I can't pronounce it because it's in German.
That's fine. But we will do the little Spotify playlist to accompany the pod, so we'll add it on there, and I'll save your embarrassment.
But that's kind of how it reads. But it's just a brilliant, a really good. And again, it for me, it was one of those sort of catalyst songs that started drawing me away from just listening to the new wave of heavy metal. Into things that were more interesting.
Yeah.
And obviously came away from my mother.
Yeah.
So it was all that sort of stages. So, but it's more about the fact, to be honest, you can pick any Monochrome Set song, any album. They're all really class acts. That again, a bit like, as you're saying, about bands like Jesus Jones, et cetera, seem to be completely forgotten. I think they're mentioning, some geeky C86 books and stuff like that. Just great band. Just an absolute great band. They're still gigging. They're still touring and stuff like that. But, it's the sort of band you can go and see at, a small 200, 300 something. Yeah. Instead of the bands that they influenced.
Yeah.
Say if the Smiths came back, you imagine where they would play.
Yeah.
That's why I've kind of chosen that. Again, could have chosen a million.
Yeah.
For very different reasons, kind of. But.
Well, we've spoke so much about other people's music.
Hmm.
What are you up to?
So, I'm currently in a production DJ duo. We're working under the title of The Legends of the Seven Golden Vampires. We had a single out last year called Autumn Fall that did remarkably well because it was just kind of a thrown out single. It's something I did or started on because I was waiting for another project musically to finish. I wanted to do something, so I thought, I'll just piece something together. Now this goes back, it kind of follows me because I used to be heavily involved in the mashup scene of the early 2000s, so what would have been called Bastard Pop before it became popular. And used to go down to Bastard, which was the sort of seminal club for it. And was kind of heavily involved in that. So kind of revisited the kind of, I mean, the song's not a mashup.
Yeah.
It is an original thing, but, you know, thought, oh, I'll revisit the kind of sampling cut sort of side of it as well. Then joined up with a friend of mine who's a DJ called Luke, to try and sort of flesh out the vision. So basically the single was picked up by, you know, Six Music, Radio X, Absolute Radio played it the other week, and did 7 million streams on TikTok. So I don't know what that means.
It's no bad thing, I'm sure.
I'm sure it isn't. And that's kind of done. It's still doing well and stuff. So then we did we just followed up with the second track, which had kind of a more 70s funk feel. But the whole idea with the band is to look at all these influences from over the years. So the next song is going to be more of a kind of synth techno-y type, almost like an orbital type feel to it, with a guest vocalist. So the project is really about looking at our influences. We both have very similar influences, although Luke is the biggest Slayer fan. And just kind of just release songs based on looking at things. So it's kind of unapologetically retro in what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
We're deliberately looking at sounds and looking at things and kind of trying to emulate stuff from, you know, from fan favorites when we were kids.
Yeah.
But to now. So we're not trying to, it's not innovative. In any way, it really is trying to say emulate stuff that we like and then try and put obviously our own twist to it.
Sure.
So it's good. We've pretty much got an album. It's quite diverse, it's quite eclectic. So it, you know, features everything. Autumn Fall's got a very Northern Soul feel and sound to it. The second single, Close to You, it's got a real sort of funk. I think the third single will be a bit more 70s synth electro sort of thing. But I'll follow through. You know, there will be a metal track on it.
Of course there will.
There will be all these sort of bits and pieces. So, yeah, that's kind of coming to fruition. So we're just looking at... So the third single should be coming out in the next 2 months. And then the album, hopefully by the end of the year. And we're just now looking at how we're going to tour it and start putting it out. It's probably going to be something to do with Dex and me being all instrumental.
Yeah.
Same time. Because that was kind of how it was always been. It's how it's seen. Yeah. It's more of a kind of a DJ production project as opposed to full live bands. And we're just trying to get that cleared and bring that out. So hopefully we should be touring by late summer. Gigging, late summer. Not get ahead of ourselves here. So yeah, we should be gigging by the late summer, and yeah, just seeing how it all goes. But it's at the moment it seems to be doing well. So
fantastic.
Hopefully,
Nick, if people want to keep up to speed with tour dates and releases, where's the best place to stay up to speed?
We got our Instagram site, which would be legends_of_golden_vampires. Mm-hmm. We're probably the best. We tend to use Instagram more than anything now because it's easier to put a picture up and write a sentence.
Yeah.
We're doing, but that would probably be the best place.
Okay. Well, if it's cool with you, we'll tag you in it when this episode comes out so people can go and find you if they haven't done
it. Oh, absolutely. Already. Yeah, please. Go on. Yes, please. It'll be absolutely fantastic.
Wonderful.
No, absolutely fantastic.
Nick, it's been a real joy talking records with you.
Thanks to you and you. Honestly, it's just a shame it's not down a pub with a few pints.
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely.
We'll be there for the rest of the evening.
Discussing the merits of 1992 and guitars.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's been absolutely brilliant.
Thank you very much. I'm going to press stop, Nick. Don't go anywhere. Ah, oh, wonderful. What an absolute ledge. Super lovely guy. We carried on nattering afterwards, and we're definitely going to meet up and have a pint and yeah, carry on banging on about underrated bands that don't get the respect that they deserve. It was a great chat that. I hope you enjoyed it as well. It was lovely just to talk records with somebody that's got a very eclectic taste, and it always makes for a fun chat. I'm back next time, as mentioned at the beginning during the intro. Please go and check out the Patreon if you can support the podcast. I'd really appreciate it. It's 70 pence a month, and you get a bucket load of stuff for that as well. And other than that, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. There's 500 episodes available for free on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your pods. So the minimum bit you can do is subscribe or give us a like, love, share on the socials. Or why not nudge your mate and go, you heard this podcast called Off the Beaten Track with this elderly guy with a lisp that gets overexcited about music. It's called Off the Beaten Track. You should go and check it out. How do I do that, you ask? Well, let me tell you. You head over to his website, which is offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. And all the links are over there. Oh, I think I'll do that. That's what you got to do, right? So just go and, turn someone onto the website. And I'll love you a long time for that. Right, I'm back next time. In the meantime, be excellent to each other. And I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.